Okay, this is the National Truth Teleconference meeting for 9/28/2011. Anna, would you please call the roll? Let us know who's here. Just read down the list.
Ken Freeland, Anna Yeisley, Sheila Casey, Craig McKee, Shelton Langford, and Don Stahl are on the call.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Our first order of business, as usual, is to concur in the draft minutes that's helpfully circulated by Anna. Does anybody have any amendment to the minutes as they were posted and circulated? If not, then we'll take those for approved. Circulated a draft agenda for tonight. Does anybody have an amendment to the draft agenda? Hearing none, then we'll proceed with the draft agenda as adopted for our use tonight. We're going to have to postpone updating the Citizens 9/11 Commission because George isn't here yet to give that update. But if worse comes to worse, I'll fill in for him. Let's see, 9/11 Truth Teleconference internal issues. Okay, we have a few housekeeping issues to take care of tonight. The first is a proposal to revert to monthly rather than twice monthly meetings. Annie Yeisley has been proposing it, so Anna, why don't you go ahead and motivate it?
I'd like to, recommend? Move that we reduce the number of calls per month to once a month as they were previously. As we got close to the 10th anniversary, I think it was me that suggested that we go to twice a month. Now things settled down a little bit, so I'd like to move that we go to once a month.
Okay. Would anybody like to speak against the proposal? Okay. Then does anybody want to speak in favor of the proposal? Okay. I would assume, Anna, that your suggestion would be that we revert to the last Wednesday of the month as was the previous practice?
That would be perfect.
That's the assumption, okay. So it would be a proposal to only meet on the last Wednesdays of the month. Does anybody oppose that? Well, let's try a voice vote here. All in favor of having our meetings only on the last Wednesday of the month until further notice, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, the proposal passes, and we will now, I guess, so that we will meet again the last Wednesday of this month, but after that it will only be on the last Wednesday of the month unless there's a motion to change that. Is that how everybody understands that?
This is the last Monday, Wednesday.
Thank you. I was thinking it was the second Wednesday. Okay, so we will not meet. We will not have another one until the last Wednesday of October.
October,
okay.
Which is the 26th of October.
Okay, very well. All right, so let's move on to the second part then. Discussion has come up about the, who joined us?
James Hufford.
James, welcome back.
Thank you.
We were just about to get into we just agreed, James, that we are now going to revert to monthly meetings rather than bi-monthly meetings. Mm-hmm. So the next meeting will be the last Wednesday in October.
Okay.
The internal, listserv issue has been coming up again and again. Several people have complained about the high volume of email being generated by the listserv. Several people actually dropped off this week, although one has to be restored, because people can't handle the high volume of mail. Various proposals have been, shot around about how we might address this question, but none of them has proved satisfactory. I'm asking that we open discussion to looking at how we might resolve the problem of high email traffic on the listserv in a way that will allow people that wish to maintain this contact with us without having to be dealing with emails that don't actually affect the 9/11 Truth Teleconference directly. Would anybody like to make a comment or a suggestion?
This is Anna Yeisley.
Anna Yeisley, you're first. Who else would like to speak?
I would. This is Sheila.
Sheila's behind Anna. Who else? Go ahead, Anna.
I'd like to clarify the parameters. I think we did have some email correspondence on listserv regarding what are the parameters of the call, what would be outside the parameters, what would be within, and I'm still not, you know, real clear on that. So could we have a discussion talking about the, you know, what are the parameters of the call? So we know when we're stepping
outside. The parameters of the call or the parameters of the listserv?
All right, the parameters of the listserv. Should I go back to the Yahoo group and find out what the parameters are, or could someone state them?
That would be the idea. Well, that might be a good point of departure, but I think somebody just came on the call. Did somebody just come on the call?
Yeah, Paul Zaremka.
All right, welcome back, Paul.
Sure.
Anybody else on the call that we haven't included in the role yet? Okay. So, Anna, would you care to read, can you look at that and go ahead and read it to us, and then we can go from there so everybody has that sense of what the official parameters are supposed to be?
Oh, I don't have those.
Oh, you don't have it. Okay, well, let me pick it up.
I
can get it pretty quick.
Okay.
Ooh, that was pretty nasty noise.
it makes that funny noise when I switch back over to my speakerphone. Sorry about that.
Okay. Here's what it says on our website homepage. I'm sorry, our listserv homepage. A coalition of 9/11 truth leaders and representatives of 9/11 truth groups have been communicating on a monthly basis via teleconference on supporting campaigns that could be critical in support in exposing the cover-up and what really happened on September 11th, and on what really happened September 11th, 2001. Only those receiving invites to the teleconference will be invited to join this telecon group. In signing up for this list, you can decide on getting, that's just the techniques. We also can post files and photos and so forth. We ask that we keep the discussion here for our group. A few minutes and background on the teleconference group, see the following related link. That's it. So I'll repeat the part that's probably most relevant here. The first sentence, have been communicating on the month, oh, I'm sorry, that's what we've been communicating on the teleconference. It doesn't say anything really about the parameters of what can be discussed on the listserv. We ask that we keep the discussions here for our group, so that there's a question about some discretion here, but there isn't any question about topical parameters. Okay, there's nothing stated about that. So that's the only thing that's been set in stone as far as the definition goes. So do you want to proceed, Anna, or should we go to Sheila?
Well, so it isn't the topics that we consider too much, or it seems to be. Is it just the volume of emails, not the topics, that's the main point of contention?
Well, I think they're related. The volume of email that directly pertains to the functioning of 9/11 Truth is not very large at all, and I doubt that we would have any complaints if our emails were limited to that. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of the posts that come through the listserv have to do with debates and discussions about points in 9/11 Truth rather than the 9/11 Truth teleconference. And that's where we're getting people complaining about the volume of mails, which can, then generally, I've seen it go as high as 20 a day already. It's pretty high.
Well, I just send the emails to a folder, so then I can, view it. I can choose to view it. I wonder why other folk don't do that.
Well, apparently some people feel that they don't want to have to even do that. They don't want to have to go through a lot of emails to sort through emails to see who said what about what different topic.
Mm-hmm.
But then others, for others of us, that is interesting and worthwhile doing so. We really need to, I think, make a decision here about what the listserv should be used for, and then go from there to decide whether or not our existing listserv is a place for that purpose, or whether there's a need for an auxiliary mode of communication.
Well, in the paragraph that you read out, it says it's a coalition of truth leaders supporting campaigns critical in exposing the cover-up on 9/11.
Supporting campaigns that could be critical in exposing the cover-up.
So isn't that a pretty, so every email that is not supporting a campaign, you know, maybe we could use that as a, guiding.
Okay, so an email that's not in support of a particular campaign would then be...
That's not what it says.
Let me read it again. A coalition of 9/11 truth leaders and representatives of 9/11 truth groups have been communicating on a monthly basis on supporting campaigns that could be critical in exposing the cover-up and on what really happened September 11, 2001. Okay. Unfortunately, it can be interpreted. It does not itself apply directly to the list of per se, but if we make an inference from it, we might be able to take it in that kind of a direction if that's what we want to do.
We could have somebody...
Now, wait a second. I thought we had a list here where I was waiting to be told that it's my turn to talk.
You are.
Yeah,
you are.
I'm sorry.
Are you finished, Anna?
I mean...
Yes, I am.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sheila.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Who wanted to go after Sheila?
James.
Who?
James.
Dan, okay, so you're after...
James, yeah.
James, okay.
Okay.
First of all, it says, on supporting campaigns that could be critical in exposing the cover-up, and on what really happened, September 11, 2001. So I think that and on what really happened basically covers all the discussion about what really happened. So I do think that the discussion that we're having is covered in here. I don't think the problem has to do with, I don't really feel a desire to try to limit the discussion per se. I find a lot of the comments and the discussion to be interesting. It's not that I would have certain topics that I would want to eliminate. It's more that there are certain people whose views I do not find helpful to read. And so some of those people, one of those persons, I have just simply blocked their, put a filter on, so I don't even see their email. And what I've done the same thing Anna's done, which is I've got a folder set up and, set up a filter so that any email that comes in that has 911 telecon in the subject header automatically goes into that folder, and I can just check the folder whenever I want. I actually don't think we should change the system. The reason being is that when there was a lot of discussion about changing the system, and when I proposed a solution that would make it work more like another Yahoo group that I'm on, there were no responses to it whatsoever. So even though there have been a few complaints, there doesn't seem to be any energy from anyone to actually change anything. And when Ken set up an alternative method that was based out of Houston 9/11 Truth, it was difficult to get people to use it. I posted a few comments over there that nobody ever responded to, which made me feel like, why am I posting over here that nobody apparently is even reading it? And while everyone else was just continuing to post to the listserv. So I, at this point, feel like maybe we should just drop it and leave people to form their own solutions as a way of, dealing with the mail.
I agree. Sheila, this is Anna.
James is next, and I'll put you after James. Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask Sheila a question.
Go ahead.
Is that all right, James?
Okay. Sure. Go ahead.
What was your suggestion? I might have missed it. I did have missed a lot of emails to the listserv. What was your suggestion to reduce the number of emails?
I'm on another Yahoo group that's for people who feed their dogs raw, and they have a very strict rule over there that says that when you reply to an email, that your email needs to contain only the text that you yourself have personally written, because that makes it possible to do the daily digest and to quickly scan down it and read each email only once. I try to do the daily digest very briefly with this listserv group, this Yahoo group. It doesn't work at all because you spend more time scrolling through a massive email where almost every email is going to be seen 6 or 7 or more times because it simply is part of the long chain that goes down the page when people hit reply and their little bit of text gets added at the top, you know, while all the other emails prior to it remain. So that makes the daily digest very difficult to use. I think it works pretty well over at the raw feeding group because the daily digest works. So if people could be, if we had that as a rule, then people could do the daily digest, and that would be one email a day. That's not that much.
I have tried to do. I use my BlackBerry a lot, and I can't seem to figure out how to select. It will only select what I'm the new note that I'm doing. So I'm not sure you can do it on a BlackBerry. I don't know if anyone else has had that problem, but I think it's a good. That's a good idea. On the other hand, I don't use that one daily digest. I don't like having to search. I like having all those other emails below my comments.
Okay.
So
Anna, let's let James have a chance to speak,
okay.
And then we can put you in the stack behind you. Okay. Go ahead, James.
Okay. I don't have anything very revolutionary to say. For one thing, I suppose that there could be a system of having all emails cleared by someone or by a group to make sure that they're germane and that they follow the rules. But the problem with that, of course, is that nobody's going to be on there all the time to do that and probably want to take on the work to do it. But it would be one way to do it. And another possibility would be that if all of the just plain back and forth between two people were some way or other kept apart from the general flow, and they could just talk back and forth and wouldn't add to the email load of the rest of us, then that would cut down very considerably on the flow, I think.
You're a genius, James. I'm going to put myself on the stack behind Anna because I've got an idea of that might make that work. Go ahead, Anna.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I agree with Sheila to just leave it be. I'm a proponent for free information. I mean, free expression of information, and I'm always interested in what people have to say, and I find the list very interesting, bar, one or two, too much over hashing and rehashing, and I'm not,
yeah.
I hate the insulting.
and everybody can just deal with it as they can, I mean, take it for what it is. It isn't perfect.
Yeah.
Okay, I'd like to take up James's thought there. The Yahoo Groups has an option that we could consider that would make the default, instead of going to the entire group, going to the individual who wrote the email to which you're responding, if you are responding to an email. Mm-hmm. Now, you could still send it to the group, but to do so, you have to actually do the work of forwarding it rather than replying, okay? So you would just put the group's email address in your reply. But I think if people were aware each time, do I really need this to go to the whole group, or is this just something that, I can take on with this particular individual, that might serve to curtail the amount of email. The disadvantage of that, of course, is that all these back and forths, you wouldn't be aware of them, and if there was something that was interest there, you wouldn't be aware of it if it was only going on between two people. But then that's going to be up to the individuals themselves to determine whether it needs to be going to the whole group, whether they want group participation in the conversation, or whether, they basically just want to have a tete-a-tete with that particular individual's point or something. Anybody else want to speak?
Yeah, I will. This is Sheila. I often do reply to a single person simply by, using their email address. Mm-hmm. I guess I think most of the time I'm wanting to reply to the entire group because we're having kind of a group discussion.
Okay.
And I don't actually think it's that often that it becomes just between two people.
Okay.
So, but, you know, I would be okay with doing it that way. I just think that it actually makes more work for most of us because, you know, I think that most of the time we are going to be forwarding a full group.
Okay. Any other thoughts on this?
Maybe I'm not really okay with it. I mean, I don't think it's actually an improvement.
Okay.
But I want to say, Ken, I really have appreciated your diligence in trying to find a solution.
Well, I appreciate that, too. The problem with that is a cart and a horse thing. In order for the bulletin board system could have worked, but it would require a people committee to go ahead and, you know, having it set up for email notifications so that it would be work function the same way as a listserv, and they would be aware of what everybody was saying on every subject that they were interested in and not on the subjects that they were not interested in, and then it would work. But people have to be willing to make a commitment to it in the first place. The reason why you didn't get any responses is because only about 3 or 4 people took up the experiment. So there was only 3 or 4 people that would possibly have been able to reply. And not all of them even had their email notifications set up properly. It's kind of
That one that I said nobody replied to, I sent that to the listserv.
Oh. Oh, I thought you were talking about, hey, you made a post over there at the bulletin board and you didn't get a reply.
No, I said this. In 2 different cases, I posted several things over at the bulletin board that nobody replied to. That is true.
Okay.
It's also true that I posted a solution for the listserv on the listserv and didn't get a reply to that other than you.
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess I would like to take a straw poll here of the people who are on this call because, after all, the people who show up to the teleconference are the ones who really are empowered to make decisions. So I'm going to ask to take a straw poll here. How many people think that there is enough of an issue here that we need to devise a solution? If you agree with that, say aye. How many people think that the existing situation is manageable enough that we shouldn't make any changes in the way that we're communicating internally at this point? Say aye if you agree with that.
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, well, that's pretty close to a consensus, so I'm going to just suggest that we are probably not in a position right now to do anything about it because there's not a will to do anything about it, and therefore we should move on to some better topic, some more fun topic.
I did have one other thing to say on that topic, if I could.
Please go ahead, Jill.
I do think that the listserv should be for people who are on the teleconference, and I know of at least one person who's on the listserv quite a bit who I've never seen on the teleconference.
Really? Well, that is a violation because it is strictly set up for people on teleconference.
Dennis Morisseau, I don't believe he's ever been on the teleconference.
Hmm.
And I see him on the listserv all the time.
Okay, if it pleases... The teleconference here, I will write him a message requesting that he do one of 2 things, either begin showing up to the teleconference or be unsubscribed from the listserv because it is restricted to people who are involved in the teleconference. Does that mean with Google?
I would agree with that.
Okay. Does anybody have an objection to that proposal? Okay. Then I'll do that. Go ahead,
it
Jill.
Also seems that people should be removed from the listserv once they have maybe missed, I don't know, we would say a number, like 3 or 4 teleconferences. I mean, lately, we could have, you know, we could have said 3 or 4 months. That would have been, you know, if you haven't been on here, say, since February, you've missed a lot of teleconferences. So it does seem like the listserv should be pared down and, you know, periodically to, you know, getting rid of the people who haven't been on here in months.
Okay. I'm going to translate what you just said as a proposal that anyone who misses 3 teleconferences in a row without excuse, okay, without excuse means they don't say to the teleconference, I'm not going to be able to make the next two meetings because I'm going to be in Brazil or something, okay? So anybody with three unexcused absences from the teleconference will be pruned from the list. Or
unless you're talking about Senator Gravel. I would like to keep him on the loose, sir. Well, he never participates, right? But I guess maybe that would still hold for him too.
So,
a little too severe. Maybe we could make it four. Well, I guess no. Actually, that would make it. Yeah, I think
the opposite. 4 months.
I think three is good. I'm sorry. Yeah, three is good.
Okay. All right. So the proposal is that anyone who misses teleconferences in a row will be automatically unsubscribed from the listserv. Would anybody like to speak against the proposal? We've already heard Sheila motivated, so does anybody want to speak against that proposal? Okay. Then if somebody wants to speak against it, let's go ahead and say, all in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? Okay. Well, that sounds like it might be a partial solution to our problem.
It might encourage folk to go ahead and announce themselves on the call since.
Ah, good point. There's an inducement for sure.
If they don't, they'll get off. So,
let's ask: should we make this retroactive, or should it start now? People who have not been on, let's say, the last three teleconferences, would we want to start unsubscribing them, or maybe?
Let's start now.
Start now. Okay.
I think it should be retroactive because I'm thinking of people like Richard Gage, for example, who has not been on the entire time I've been on the teleconference, say, since March. And that's a long time.
Well,
okay.
What about the invitee list? Does that need to be discussed? I mean, there's a lot of folk who are getting I guess it's just a minute. So I guess that really is
true. Yeah, the invitee list is only for draft agenda and minutes. That's the only thing that we use that for. We don't use it for anything else right now. So that that's because everybody's not on the listserv. Okay, if everybody were on the listserv, we wouldn't need to do that. But since they're not, and you know, we can't compel people to do that, so we have a separate list that we use, an emailing list to send out the vital information for the teleconference.
Well, I think folks should know of the new suggestion or before we remove them. So,
it does bring up a question, which is this. If people who have been continually invited to the teleconference are never showing up to the teleconference, do we want to continue to invite them? And I don't know that that's an important question, but I thought we should maybe look at that in passing here.
I guess I'm not all that concerned about exactly who gets invited because I think people who know about it don't really need to be invited. You know, you have a way of getting the phone number.
Yeah.
So I don't know that the invitation is that important, but I am, you know, I do feel that it needs, you know, I'd like to see the subscriber list to the listserv be circumscribed more closely than it currently is. I don't like the idea that we're having a back and forth that feels relatively personal and, you know, could be read by dozens of people who are never chiming in.
All right, so then an amendment. Well, we can't really. Yeah, we can move to amend our previous proposal and make it retroactive. Anyone who has not been on the listserv on the teleconference for the last three. Tell you what, let me make a suggestion that we make it five. We make the retroactive five, and we make the forward three. Okay.
Yeah.
That gives everybody a fair chance that might have just been absent for the last few times, and nobody will be too surprised by this.
I think three is okay because if you inform people, I suppose if they're interested enough to protest and ask to be let on, you'd let them on anyway. So.
Well, I think you're right. I think we agree to that as far as forward going, is concerned, okay?
Yeah.
But now that we're talking about retroactive, okay, and those people did not have any kind of warning, I think we should extend it
for retroactive. So.
Yes.
And that's a good idea because we were doing twice a month, of course. So really is,
A lot of teleconferences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, there's not a lot of teleconferences. So maybe we should say six to make it really fair, okay?
Yeah,
so six retroactive and three forward from now on. If anybody meets either of those criteria, they will be unsubscribed from the listserv, and a message will be sent to them informing them why they are being unsubscribed and inviting them to rejoin the conference.
Good.
Okay. Does that mean everybody's through?
This is going to apply to the listserv moderator, Jonathan Mark.
Well, no, it won't, for this reason. Jonathan Mark has the unusual situation of having a technical issue, okay? He cannot join our teleconferences since we moved to Teleconference Pro. His phone will not accept him putting in the access code. So he has to be an exception. He has to be an exception for that reason. He simply cannot at this point join. He is trying to work on the technical end issue, but at this point there's no way he can join us. I would say he has to be accepted.
Okay.
If that's all right with everyone. I think we have a plan for that. That's good work. Let's see what else we got on the agenda here. I think those were all the major items we had on the agenda, so I think at this point we can move back into discussion mode of announcements and continuing open discussion of issues in the 9/11 truth movement. However, I would like to put myself first on the stack to make an announcement. Anybody else?
Ken, the Citizens 9/11 Commission report, didn't you say you were going to report on that? We usually do a report on the Citizens 9/11.
You're right. Thank you for reminding me. Yes. I can just go ahead and make my announcement as I'm doing this, okay? After long and arduous negotiation, I have been given an appointment to work with the Citizens 9/11 Commission in the capacity of, I don't have a title yet, but I'll be working with helping them with their communications and helping to promote the campaign, especially in the 9/11 Truth Movement, but in general to get its message out. So,
congratulations.
It's not going to be a sinecure by any means. It's not a well-paying type of position. It's actually what I would call full-time work on part-time pay. But it's something I really, really look forward to doing because I think possibly most of you know that I've been a strong votary of this campaign since its inception. And I'm really looking forward to sinking my teeth into it and helping it get off the ground as a national spectacle, as a national presence in the 9/11 Truth Movement, but much more importantly, also beyond the 9/11 Truth Movement. So that people can get a feel for this. I don't want to go on and on about this, but I'm just thrilled to be able to be doing this, with my time now so that I can really focus on it and help them move it along. So I will be glad to give what updates I'm aware of, and I will work on getting Senator Gravel more involved in our teleconferences over time. I know he really likes to be here when he can, but he is extremely busy right now, and he's heading over to Europe probably in October to do a fundraising tour over there, so he'll be out of pocket at that point probably. But from time to time, we do want to get him here in person to give us a pep talk and to update us on some of the issues involved in the campaign.
Could we get David Ray Griffin on a conference call sometime just to visit with him? And
that's a great idea.
That's a great idea, but. It's not related to the Citizens 9/11 Commission, but I will suggest that you bring that up as a speaker when we get back into discussion mode, okay?
Sure.
James? Okay, because I think it's something that other people have suggested already, and I don't doubt that there's support for the idea, so let's just hold on for a moment till I complete the update. Let's see. probably the most significant thing about happening with the 9/11 Commission campaign is that, as probably most of you know, a fellow whose first name is Matthew, and I don't know his last name, but he was the producer of the hit film Amelie, gave a large donation, a very large donation, to the Commission campaign. And this has really made it possible for us to do many things that we were not able to do in the past, including to negotiate a professional citizen petition gathering service in Massachusetts, which is, of course, our key state to focus on right now. And I know y'all are aware of that. I wish I had more information on the Massachusetts campaign, but it's just getting off the ground. So next time I'll be sure that somebody who's informed about the Massachusetts campaign per se can give you an update on that. But the total of contributions at this point has just reached the $80,000 mark. Okay? Mm-hmm. And that's going to empower the 911CC to really establish a presence in Massachusetts and beyond as far as getting these petitions going and getting these things on the ballots and bringing this thing into fruition. So I think that's the biggest news right now. And our website, thanks to me, is finally reflecting this actual level of donations. So the original goal to get the thing in Massachusetts to work was about $100,000. So we're about four-fifths of the way there for that. Of course, there will be other expenses down the line as we move into other states and so forth. My goal is to make the website an accurate picture of the campaign so that anybody going to it will be able to get whatever information they want about the campaign and about what they can do to help. And so I will appreciate any input that you wish to send me privately as to how things could be improved, as the things you're not seeing that need to be seen, and so forth and so on as we continue, because I am now in charge of the website's approach, its appearance. And we've got a lot of plans for how that's going to happen. That'll take several weeks to revamp it totally. But in the meantime, we want to do some quick changes, one of which will be editing a wonderful speech that I urge you all to listen to in full. But we're going to do an edited version of it in place of the one that's on there now by Senator Gravel. This is the one that he gave to the Massachusetts State House. Have any of you seen that?
Yes.
Would you agree, James, that it's an excellent speech about, it's an awesome speech. Would you agree? and so editing that properly will give everybody a better feel for Senator Gravel and for this project and why it's so important. And that will be our keynote feature of the website in the immediate future. Again, any suggestions that any of you have for how we can make the campaign more accessible to people and more informative, I would appreciate your sending them to me directly, and I will do everything I can to implement all the good suggestions.
Hello?
Website.
Okay.
Who's here?
Hello? Paul?
Hello. Who's here?
It's Paul Zaremka.
Paul, would you like to speak?
Yes.
Okay. So
on that $80,000 that you mentioned,
yes,
does that include the $50,000 from the French guy?
Yes, it does. That's what put us up into the stratosphere. Okay.
That's a problem because that $50,000 can't be used in Massachusetts itself. So it's only $50,000 for Massachusetts.
Yeah, you got a point there. I'm going to have to find out about how we note these. These different types of donations to communicate to people where we stand with respect to our goals. That's not completely clear to me yet because I just started on this stuff this week. So thank you for bringing that point up, and I will bring that up to the steering committee and see what they want to do about that.
I have a question too, Ken.
Yeah. Go ahead.
About Massachusetts. Now, I was thinking they were talking about closing up shop, that they've done what they can do in Massachusetts. That one email was, you know, they didn't want to spend the energy and time on trying to get these signatures when they're not going to reach the goal. So could you update us on that?
I've not heard anything to that effect. So but I have heard those rumors, and I don't know where they come from. Since you bring that up, I'm going to assume that those rumors are pretty rife in the 9/11 Truth community, and I will make it a top priority to get all the information that there is about this and do an update that will be linked or posted on the home page sometime within the next 48 hours, okay?
I'm sure you have George Ripley's phone number, don't you? Because I think
he may have. And George was supposed to be on his call, and you know what?
We should have. Somebody should have called him because he may have.
Yes, yes. We should get him on the line here. We should get him involved because he did say that he would be here tonight, and I sent him the info. But
I'm
going to
give him a phone call right here, real quick.
All right, you can do it.
Yeah, I can do it. I've got him right here.
Thank you.
On my call. Okay.
Great. Just remind him that we're in the conference call. We need him to answer some questions that I'm not able to answer for the teleconference, okay?
Very good.
Paul, you wanted to make a comment. Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. You already did anybody else want to comment or ask a question or anything?
Actually, I just wanted to say something, Craig McTee. I seem to recall that the senator was talking about 300,000 being needed for Massachusetts alone. That's what I remember. So it seems like we're like a lot.
I believe you're correct, and I believe our meter is not showing that correctly, but we're stuck with the meter that was put on there for right now. I'm working with the web technician to get this stuff straightened out so that it's much clearer where we stand and what we have to get to work to our goal. And that hasn't been clarified yet.
So
you were asking some really important questions, and this stuff will all get straightened out within the next few days. Believe me, it's the top of my list of stuff to get done.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Any other comments or questions?
Ken, this is Sheila. Is this your new full-time job then?
This will be my full-time engagement, yes. Like I said, I'm not being given full-time pay for it, but I'm certainly going to give it a full-time effort. It's going to be my full involvement from here until I'm told I'm no longer needed, okay? So, yes, I'm fully engaged with the campaign right now.
Well, good for you. They're lucky to have you.
Thank you, Sheila.
You're
I appreciate
here.
That. And I hope that all of you will be giving thought in your local groups to joining as affiliates with the campaign, which you can now do. You can formally join as affiliates, and I'm just getting that part of the deal started so that people can become actually part of the campaign in their home communities. There will be things that have to be done locally as well as nationally by action groups. One of the things that we're talking about now is already going to local municipalities and asking for motions to support the 9/11 campaign, even though it's not yet ready for the joint powers thing that will happen once we get it passed in one of the states. So that's something that could be done on a local level if anyone is interested in doing that or helping to develop other local strategies in support of the campaign. Please affiliate with us. And you'll be included in the discussion of what the local affiliates can be doing to promote the campaign. There's an affiliate button under our banner. There's a thing that says volunteer or something like that. And there's an affiliate option there. So just follow that, and you'll get it.
You know, one thing that I think would be helpful, Ken, would be to have, and maybe they do have this and I just haven't seen it, but have some kind of a timeline about what the significant dates are and when things need to be submitted and what dates you need to have how much money raised by. Because so far for me, this has been kind of very amorphous other than that it all needs to be done right away.
Yeah, you're right. That's exactly the kind of information that the website should be promulgating right now. It should be right there in front of people to look at or to be able to access so that everything is crystal clear. But we're working toward that kind of transparency, but unfortunately, in this transitional point, the person who was doing it before was doing it as a volunteer. I didn't have a lot of time. It's now found a new job, and is not able to assist too much in the transition. So it's difficult to get this stuff clarified. But it's going to become clarified, and it will all be crystal clear anon. But I can't tell you exactly when that will happen by. But I'm telling you that it's my first priority right now. And you will see changes on the website on a daily basis until it gets to the point where it's transparent.
Also, we were told in my local group by George that they were burning through $40,000 a week just running the campaign, which made me think, wow, they're going to really need to raise more funds, you know. I mean, if it's $40,000 a week just to run the campaign.
Well, I think what he told, what he said, my understanding was that they're going to need $40,000 a week to hit a certain goal to have a certain amount of money for have that before a certain time. I'm not sure if they were saying that they were spending $40,000, but they were going to need to receive $40,000 a week for a certain amount of time to hit a certain financial goal by time. So I'm thinking that's my understanding.
Yes, it's confused. I agree, and it has to be clarified, and it's going to be my job to make that clear. And make it clear to everybody so nobody has to ask questions about it. Give me a week, and hopefully in a week's time, this stuff will all be clear and transparent. Okay.
I have the email in front of me. What George actually said is our burn rate is $40,000 a week for the next 6 weeks, which to me made it sound like they were burning through $40,000 a week.
Yeah, he explained it to me, so I got a different picture of what he was saying. So, yeah, clarification is good.
So who was trying to get George on the line?
So they're not spending 40 a week?
I did oh. Try to get him, and I got his voicemail.
Huh. Okay. Well, I guess we're going to have to do without him for tonight, but by the next teleconference, we'll be sure to have somebody here, not me, who's totally informed on these questions and can answer everybody's questions. Okay, let's revert back to our normal discussion mode then that we usually conclude our conferences with. Would anybody like to say anything and make an announcement or discuss an issue?
Shelton. I just want to. Shelton, are you still on here?
Yes.
I wanted to compliment you on your comment on Craig McKee's blog, his most recent post, and I just thought it was really well said. I appreciated what you wrote.
I've got some more to say. Thank you, Sheila. I've got some more to say. I'm going to have to be very deliberate about it because. There's a lot of things in the air right now. I'll just leave it at that. I'm reading Dr. Griffin's book, and I wanted to finish that before I commented.
Which one?
His latest one.
Just a quick announcement. George is going to join us on the call. Just got a hold of him just now.
Good job. Thank you.
He's going to be on as soon as he can.
The thing I particularly appreciated that you did, Shelton, was that you referred several times to, rather than saying the question being whether the plane hit the Pentagon, but whether the Pentagon faked a plane crash. And I really feel like that should be our terminology, you know, because I think, it preempts all the people who are going to say things like, but people saw a plane. Yeah, we know people saw a plane. We're not saying nobody saw a plane. And also it brings it down to, I think, what, you know, the reason why this has been subject to such an intense counterintelligence operation, because they know that that's their Achilles heel, the faked plane crash.
I would like to see the leadership of 9/11 take up that question.
I'd like to comment on it. I've heard you say this on the listserv, Sheila, but it's like – coming at, like, I have a problem with folks saying that the government's lying and, you know, it's like an accusatory to fake a plane crash. It's really easy for someone to say that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. On the other hand, if you come out with there were explosives in the building, that's what Barbara's, you know, thrust is. There's explosives. So what, no matter when it hit, the most important thing is to the, what created the damage was the explosives. So I'm not sure it's leading out with a fake, you know, that's right at this point with so little, well, not so little evidence. I guess there is evidence, but I would stay away from drawing conclusions and, I don't think that would be a good...
Asking a question isn't drawing a conclusion.
Asking a question, mm-hmm. Well, wouldn't suggesting that faking, I don't know. I'm not so keen on that.
More eloquent.
We're trying to convince people, and I think that would right away that would be flaked off or, you know, brushed off.
Well, it totally depends who the audience is. And,
yeah, that's true.
And also, I don't have any forming conclusions because I feel like if I've done the research and I can back up my reasons for having a conclusion, that it's kind of absurd to pretend that you haven't formed a conclusion.
I'd like to get on the stack here sometime.
George Ripley George, just came on.
George, are you?
Stack?
Okay, I'm sorry. Who has to be on the stack?
Paul.
Yeah. Okay, I'll put you on the stack, Paul. Do you mind if we give George a chance to answer the questions that we've accumulated here?
No, okay. Let's hear what Paul has to say while we're in the midst of it.
Okay.
No, I'd like to get on the stack too, Craig.
Okay, Paul, then Craig. George, we had some questions for you, but we're at a point of a different discussion right now, so we're going to finish this discussion off and then come back to ask the questions to you about the 9/11 Commission's finance, okay?
Of course.
Okay. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to make a comment about Griffin's book. For those of you that haven't read it yet, maybe you can check this out for yourself and think if I'm correct or not. Many of the chapters are actually reprints or rewrites of things he's already published. There's basically three chapters that are new. The last one, which is kind of the summary, that's understandable. The only other two are the one on the Pentagon, which is number 7, and number 5 is the one on phone calls and not being made from the plane. And I read that chapter 5 yesterday, and so I'm changing the subject away from the Pentagon to the voice morphing. And Griffin misses something there that I think is quite important. He spent a lot of time talking about calls which must have been faked and probably had voice morphing, but although he keeps open the possibility that there might be some other way in which it was done. But he misses the fact that many of the people like Todd Beamer Todd Beamer and also Glick, all three of those people were late arrivals for that plane, so they would not have known, anybody who was setting them up for a voice morphing would not have known that they were on the plane. Therefore, it was low probability of actually setting up a voice morphing for those particular individuals. And Griffin knows about that problem, but doesn't answer it. You follow what I'm saying? In other words, if he's going to make an argument that...
Yeah.
93 had a lot of voice morphing on it, then he has to confront the fact that many of the people who he talks about having been voice morphed were people who arrived late for that particular flight, who were either standby or they didn't know they would be on the flight or one thing or another. So I just want to throw that out for anybody.
No, they had not bought a ticket in advance.
That's right.
Hmm. They might be setups, though.
Well, explain that.
They could be setups. Maybe they're sent late to provide a plausible argument against somebody coming up with voice morphing.
I still don't understand. Sorry.
Are you saying that they're part of it?
Yeah, they might be.
And now they're dead?
Well, I don't know. I'm not convinced anybody was on any planes. Totally.
Weird.
Okay. Craig is waiting. Go ahead, Craig.
Yeah, I just wanted to get back to Dr. Griffin's book, and I had sort of hoped to. I'm doing an email interview with him, and I kind of hoped that I would have the answers by today, and might have some interesting answers, but that hasn't happened. But one thing that bothered me about his chapter 7 was that he kept referring to the argument being about what hit the Pentagon, and what hit the Pentagon is not, is not very important, or it's relatively unimportant. And I guess that I wish he hadn't used that terminology, because it sounds like, we're discussing something definitely hit the Pentagon, and it's just a question of what it is, which is not, he does sort of elaborate a little bit, but the main thing, I guess, that I was concerned about, and that I already wrote about, is that this idea of the consensus approach really kind of alarms me, and also the consensus 9/11 website, which I know some people on the call are involved in or listed in, but the thing about that bothers me is that there's only two things mentioned about Flight 93 or Flight 97, and they're not even, they're hardly the most sort of dramatic pieces of evidence. I can't even sort of recall off the top of my head what the one for the Pentagon is, but it's something about, maybe it's about Hani Hanjour not being able to fly the maneuver that he did, or that he was supposed to have done.
That's correct.
Something like that, but it's the only piece of evidence listed. And then, there's a response. And I don't know, I guess the thing that alarms me the most is the idea that we're going to get rid of the best evidence and just sort of settle on whatever doesn't get vetoed by David Chandler, Jonathan Cole, Jim Hoffman and company. That's kind of what I'm concerned about. And I think this is something that, we should resist, I think.
Shelton on the stack.
Yeah, you can go ahead.
Craig, I share your concern, and that's the question I'm going to address going forward with the people who put together the consensus panel. My understanding, it may have been an unwarranted assumption, that there was going to be a second phase of that.
Right.
Some of the tougher problems that they could get past in time for the Toronto hearings. And that turns out not to be the case. If there isn't going to be any further work on this, my name is coming off of that, and I will make a strong statement saying basically what you said.
Mm-hmm. Well, I sorry. Sorry, I'm not on that. I think that's the right thing to do, I think.
I was very disturbed by it, and I feel like there was people who were participating in good faith might have been used. That's what bothers me.
Let me, this is Paul again. I would like to get on the stack on this issue.
This is Sheila. I want to get on the stack.
Okay, Paul,
that's yours. Yeah, Sheldon, I don't think there's any reason why we can't say what happened. I mean, you and I probably were both on it, so we probably had the same experience. I mean, we were invited to be on the consensus panel. We were told that it would be about 20 people. We were not given the names of the people. We were given a list, I think it was of 16 questions, and not really offered. I mean, there was a slight possibility of perhaps throwing in a new question, but it was difficult. So basically, we had to take the questions that were offered to us to evaluate, and that reduced the list to 13, and that's what everybody sees out there. Now, I don't know about Sheldon, but I'll tell you, in my own case, I basically did it with, like Sheldon said, and it was in a good faith way. And I have heard, actually, Sheldon, recently that, I mean, recently means in the last 3 weeks, sometime like a week before Toronto, that they do intend to go through a second to this process. But maybe that's been dropped in the last 3 weeks. I don't know. But the other thing I'd like to say about it is I'm not sure that this consensus panel, whatever it is, has gotten many legs. I don't see a lot of attention being given to it, so I don't know that we need to be too concerned about it one way or another. I mean, what are other people saying? I don't know.
Well, I am concerned to find out whether or not that is the case, if there's going to be any kind of follow-on, and if they are ever going to take on the tougher questions. And the technique is a little deceptive because we didn't get much opportunity to propose
right. Or
points that would be subjected to consensus. I never, and I objected in two different responses to the fact that you know the ones they asked were non-controversial. There was the conventional wisdom, and it wasn't going to be introduced. It's fine. I want to back up a list of non-controversial items that you've got good solid evidence for. But if you want to get into some of the other things that haven't been so thoroughly explored, then you just leave it right there. And that becomes the body of truth that we signed up for, and I don't think that's right.
Dot stall on the stack.
Okay, Sheila, I think you were next, weren't you?
Yes.
And then Don's after you, so just go ahead when she's done, Don.
Craig, I'd like to get on again if I can.
Okay, Craig, you're after Don. Go ahead and start.
Well, I would probably go further than most people in stating that I emphatically believe that the 9/11 truth movement has been infiltrated at the highest levels of leadership. Obviously, they are not going to make it, you know, the perpetrators are not going to make an effort to coerce or persuade, either with a carrot or a stick, you know, the average truther that's standing out on the street corner with some brochures. They're going to go for the leaders. I can't say for sure about what's going on with David Ray Griffin. His book just arrived for me yesterday. I haven't read it yet. But it's very alarming to me to hear what other people are reporting, both about what he said at Toronto and what is in his book. And it also is interesting how it dovetails very neatly with the agenda that seems to be promoted by Chandler Cole, Greg Roberts, Jim Hoffman, and the most of the people on the board of directors at A&E. So what I honestly, I mean, I realize this is sounds like a shocking thing to hear and upsetting to many people, but I think what we're facing is that the A&E board seems to have been taken over by people who have an agenda to suppress the facts about a faked plane crash at the Pentagon, and now it seems that David Ray Griffin is giving them assistance. I think we've got to say that is how it appears to be.
Okay, it's my understanding that I'm supposed to pick up as soon as you stop talking. So my contribution is both to Shelton. My answer is addressed both to Shelton and to what you just said, Sheila. The idea of a consensus is not to address the truthers. It's to take our case, our strongest case, to the general public. That's what makes us truthers. There are lots of people who have their opinions and keep them to themselves, and you could call them truthers in a sense, but the question is, what does it take to get the interest and to get the time invested from people who don't want to hear it whatsoever at all? You have to take your very strongest stuff, and that is not necessarily what is logically the strongest or what is the best documented or anything else. It is what goes best into a soundbite. that is what a consensus approach is about. That's not the same as saying, well, you shouldn't talk about more extensive issues or more controversial issues. We could talk about controversial issues in the truth movement among ourselves, but that's not to say that they should be put first when we address the general public. For instance, I believe that the spire was justified. I wouldn't bring that up to the general public, though I am firmly of Judy Woods' opinion on that subject. Judy doesn't think there were explosions. I do think there were explosions, and the explanation she gives of things being pulled out of the towers, to me, is completely implausible. I would never bring that up to the general public. I would tell the general public, look at this picture. The government says the thing fell down entirely because of gravity, and you can see this and this and this and this, and they're all going upward. That's an explosion. And so there is a difference in what you say to the general public and what you try to convince other truthers of. And
can I, this is Craig, can I jump in then? Are you finished, Don?
I'm done.
Was it, that was Don Stahl just speaking?
Yes, it was.
Don, would you mind staying on the line tonight after the call? I'd like to talk to you about what you just said.
Sure.
I have an idea. Okay, thank you. Who's next on the stick? Was it?
I think it's Craig.
Craig, yes, it's Craig. Go ahead. And then,
yeah.
Craig, if we could take a break and give George an opportunity to...
I'm happy to listen to the end of the thread. I'm happy to listen
Thank you,
to the end of
okay,
the thread.
Okay, as long as you can do that, that's great, because I think this is a really scintillating discussion that we're really benefiting from. So go ahead, Craig, and then we'll just continue until we've exhausted the thread. Go ahead.
I think what we're calling consensus, I feel, is basically letting the people who believe or who are trying to convince people that a 757 hit the Pentagon, it's essentially giving them veto power over whether we're going to mention what I think is some of the strongest evidence. So I would disagree a bit with Don there. I think, consensus. I mean, you were saying that it's take the strongest case to the public. Well, I think the best way to take the strongest case to the public is to make the objective the dismantling of the official story, and to basically use everything that shows that the official story does not hold up. And I think the lack of debris at the Pentagon, Jonathan Cole can say, well, we can't absolutely prove that a plane didn't hit, but I mean, to me, that's not really the point. The point is that the evidence indicates that a plane didn't hit, and even David Ray Griffin feels that way. Mm-hmm. If you read his chapter, I mean, he tries to kind of like be like, fair to both sides, and he lists the evidence of Chandler and Cole and company, and he even refers to it at the end as impressive evidence that there was a 757 hit. But the evidence is not impressive at all. I think he's tripping over himself to be generous there, because all it is them, it's just kind of their opinion, We think a plane could have fit through the hole. We think, there's no facts to back it up. It shows, I think, one thing I like about the chapter is that it really shows how weak that whole case is, and it shows how enormously strong the other case is, which is that there was no plane. Griffin makes it a really good case. I mean, I'm upset he didn't mention CIT in the chapter, but my feeling is if you take everything that Griffin talked about, I was very interested about he mentioned the five frames of the video that allegedly show a plane that he quoted somebody who's able to prove conclusively that those frames were doctored. That was pretty interesting. I hadn't heard that before. So to me, the case that Griffin makes himself is 10 times stronger than what he's holding up as the other side of the story. And if you put that together with Barbara Honegger's evidence and CIT's evidence, then to me you've got an overwhelming case. And that's what we should be taking to the public, and not, and none of this, I mean, this idea that we have to, because none of the points that Mr. Griffin lists as the consensus points on the Pentagon, none of them are actually proof of anything. They're just strong indications of something. You know, it's unlikely they would have flown into the first level. They would have flown into the roof instead. Very true, but it's not proof of anything. So anyway, and I guess in terms of the World Trade Center, he says it's not important what flew into the World Trade Center as long as we can prove explosives, which is fine, but I think the thing is we actually can prove that now. So that makes the other thing not as important. But, you know, we don't have thermite in the dust at the Pentagon, so it's not like it's not quite the same thing, I don't think. So let's see, I want to see if there's anything else I want to mention. Yeah, I just think it's kind of like we're giving veto power to people who are whose views on the Pentagon are just, I think, very bizarre. You know, what they're willing to accept as an indication that a plane hit.
I agree with that.
She's on the stack.
Okay,
yeah, Sheila on the stack?
Sure. Okay, I don't think there's anybody else waiting, is there, to speak?
Okay.
Go ahead, Sheila.
I think, I do think we've been, all of us, subjected to a major propaganda campaign, and we've all been affected by it in various ways. Some of us have a little bit more of a backbone, maybe, or a courage of our convictions, and are able to kind of see through it, but it does seem like the vast majority of the truth movement have been kind of led in the direction of believing that the World Trade Center is where that we should be focusing our attention. And maybe they haven't given it a whole lot of thought, I don't know. I think one thing I've heard over and over is that the main question that we should be asking about the Pentagon, or the main point we should be raising, is that nothing should have hit the Pentagon anyway, and that we should put our focus there. And the thing I want to point out about what's wrong with that approach is that we're talking about a sin of omission, that nothing should have hit. We should have been able to stop whatever it was. And I can think of 100 ways and that people could make excuses for that, for something not being done, for the fighters not making it into the air, for the interception not taking place, for the anti-aircraft weaponry on the roof of the Pentagon not working, or not identifying it as a foreign aircraft or unfriendly aircraft. You know, they could think of all kinds of reasons why things fell through. But when you're talking about a sin of commission, as in, they gave the order for someone to take down those light poles in advance. They gave the order for those bombs to be planted in the building, most likely while they were doing the remodeling, and for something to be, you know, they gave the order for somebody to probably use a sledgehammer on Lloyd England's windshield to pretend to fake the light pole piercing his windshield. That all of this was done in advance. Mm-hmm. I think that is a very, very different thing to squirm out of. Mm-hmm. And any criminal would rather be accused of a sin of omission, such as I saw your life was in danger and I failed to save you, than we've got the evidence that, and we've got your DNA that, yes, your DNA is on the knife and we know you killed this person. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what we're looking at. And I really would urge... you know, I'm trying to urge the truth movement to not give up our evidence that there was a major sin of commission, and all of the cries from Victoria Ashley that nothing should have hit the Pentagon and that's where we need to focus is really throwing away our strongest, our strongest point.
Ken, I'd like to make a quick comment. Who else would like to be on the stack?
Craig.
I'll just make a quick comment.
I want to suggest, since this topic isn't on the agenda, that we could go ahead and finish up our Citizens 9/11 Commission, let George speak, and perhaps take the rest of the call off the recording, because I'd like to wrap it up for me.
I understand. So I will ask that we take a momentary break here, let George answer the questions that we had reserved for him, and then resume this discussion. However, I don't agree with turning off the recording, but I do agree with adjourning the meeting. If that's okay with you, Anna, will that suffice?
Sounds good.
Okay. Is that moving with everyone's approval?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So when we come back, it's me and then Craig. Okay. George, the questions that people had mostly concerned the questions of financing, expenses, actual goals, and how close we are to meeting them. And I don't have a lot of information yet on to give them an answer to that. So I'd like to ask anybody who had any of those questions to go ahead and let's see if George could be more helpful. I think
Anna, go ahead. On the stack. George, I was curious about Massachusetts. That's all we could do in Massachusetts. That we're pretty much closing down shop and packing up and taking a breather till the next state. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is. And yet the Massachusetts people are still demonstrating a great deal of enthusiasm for just the fact that they were the center, of course, of the action in the beginning. Because let's face it, we did really accomplish two major things on the 10th anniversary that we can all be really impressed by. And one was one was the Toronto hearings. And I hope to hear of more, because I was only party to the Toronto hearings in Massachusetts. But those two things were very impressive accomplishments for us all. And so the Massachusetts people are still, they're still enthused about the awareness and the reality that, hey, it was going to cost us $300,000 to make sure that we won in Massachusetts, and we only had 50. So where were we going to go with this? Were we going to bull on ahead with high levels of optimism, or were we going to face reality and realize it was too steep a climb to get 100,000 signatures in well, what we would have left now is 7 weeks or 6 weeks, something, 6.5 weeks, something like that. So, we were done in Massachusetts, and we realized it. And so rather than burn bridges and waste the money of the incredibly generous donation that we received in Toronto and alienate ourselves from his further efforts to raise money for us and with us, we just realized the reality was we needed to keep our powder dry and move on to the next battle that we have in front of us. So everybody's still motivated. I would say people are still motivated in Massachusetts. They're realizing too that maybe there's no need for them to carry ballots with them in the future, although they can, then they might, because actually one of those ballots is it could be a collectible as far as that goes, because it's the first shot heard around the world. People are still motivated. That's all I can say there. And they're going to be ready 2 years from now when we go back into that state.
This is Paul. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Yeah, sure, Apple.
George, are you saying that you're dropping out of Massachusetts?
Now I've stepped in it, you see, because nobody – well, I will say yes, that's what we're saying. But there are people who, how do I say this? The realities are that we don't have the money to achieve the signature gathering. If they say that if we got 10% from volunteers of the 100,000 signatures, that would be an achievement. And 10% doesn't get us there. It doesn't get us there. So it's not that we're pulling out. It's that we've begun the climb. We're not pulling out of anywhere in this country. We're just facing the reality that some hurdles we can't finish, some obstacles in the course we cannot achieve at this time.
Well, I mean, let me be argumentative here. I mean, we had the same situation in New York City. I mean, we couldn't climb that over for a different reason. Okay, now we're going to say to people, well, we can't do it in Massachusetts. So, and then we're going to go to Oregon, let's say. Okay, and then in Oregon, what are we going to say? We're going to say, well, Oregon's so far away from New York City that people in Oregon, they don't want to sign a petition about New York City and Oregon. I mean, we can go on and on with making that kind of argument that there's never the case where we really put our feet down.
Now wait a minute, Paul. We have 6 or 7 weeks now to collect 100,000 signatures, and we have you've got to look at the realities. I forget how many volunteers in Massachusetts were on hand and ready to go, but it wasn't a lot. And there was somebody asked Frank Tlopko, my friend from my part of the Berkshires, where I was raised, the western end of the state. He's the organizer out there. And he asked Susan Serpa, one of the other organizers from Boston, when I introduced them the other night, and he said, well, what are some of the key drawbacks in the Boston area? And Susan said, watch out for a guy named Lenny. Now, if you were in New York, you know Lenny. Susan,
I know,
said,
Lenny very well.
Susan says the destruction of the Massachusetts effort is in good part to Lenny. And,
oh, come on.
Well, I don't know. I apologize because now I remember – you know, we've met a couple of times. We met in Toronto, and then we met in Boston, and you hosted us there in Boston. At any rate, so if this is the first time you're hearing this conversation about Massachusetts, I apologize for not knowing right off the bat that I should have addressed you from I'm surprised that you're not knowledgeable of this conversation.
I am not knowledgeable of the fact that you were not any longer trying to get 80,000 signatures in Massachusetts. That's correct. I did not know that.
Well, I haven't read all the emails that I've missed while I've been gone, but I understand that there has been a very, very significant thread between the Pioneer Valley, Jonathan Mark, and Doug White and others who have been looking at the issue and discussing it at length. So
okay, can I push my point to Oregon? Why do you think you're going to succeed in Oregon?
It's roughly, I don't know exactly what the rules are in Oregon yet. I know there are others that have talked about it. But we have 6 months in Oregon. We have 6 months, I believe, in California, or Colorado, I mean, which is another state we're interested in doing. And Alaska, I don't know what the scene is there. But none of them were as stringent a requirement as Massachusetts. And remember that we did Massachusetts totally on the fly. We heard about this deadline. Mike was off on a trip to the Mediterranean to do some lecturing on something, and he had to get his language of the summary of the ballot proposition, which goes on the top of the application. He was developing that with the Attorney General's office from overseas. It turned out to be three times longer than they suggested it should be, because, you know, for whatever reason, and actually the length makes the marketing of the issue more complicated, because people don't have, they're passing by on other errands when they're asked to stop and sign this thing, and if they want to read it to inform themselves of its content, and then they find themselves having to read five long paragraphs, you know, it's quite an ordeal for them to have to hold their shopping bags and drop everything and read this and then sign it. So it's an uphill battle. We learned a lot in Massachusetts. And so it's not the end of the fight. We're just, the idea is the investment money has to be used with wisdom. We can't squander that because our next big shot in the arm like that is not in hand yet. We have some ideas, but we're not there yet.
George, you mentioned about you needing $40,000 a week for so long. Was that one reason why you pulled out of Massachusetts, because there was no way you could make that $40,000, or was that what you were spending a week?
No, that's correct. That's correct. There was no way. We had $40,000 in hand, here's the way it happened. We were promised. The original words that Matthew said when he offered, he raced over to me and he said, "I'm in for $60,000. Then when he got up in front of the microphone with Mike, it was $50,000, and what we ultimately got was about $45,000. And that was drawn out. It didn't happen. You know, he didn't fly right back to France and deal with it. He was there for a film fest. And by the way, I'll be interested to know, he came to the Toronto hearings as a skeptic. He wasn't there for the Toronto hearings. He was there for a Toronto film fest. He heard about the Toronto hearings, decided to come over and see what was going on, was skeptical, and in 4 days' time became a $50,000 donor. So that was a pretty remarkable deal. But the money didn't land in the bank until for 2 weeks. And so we were holding off the professional, the signature gatherer that, you know, we're dealing with. We were holding him in arm's length because not only did we not have the original $50,000, we didn't have any other fish on the line either. So our burn rate at $300,000 to complete this effort was simply, we couldn't meet it. And so to have spent that $40,000 immediately on a contract would have meant that we would have been on the hook for another $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 just by signing the contract, since the circulation, the petition gathering outfit, all their costs are upfront costs. So, or a lot of their costs are upfront costs. So they would have had to take our $40,000, spend it all immediately, and then be waiting breathlessly for the next $40,000 to cover their costs because they'd gotten the ball rolling. So, you know, we were going to have to do that week after week after week, Mike was becoming exhausted. He's at 81 years old. He can't do everything, so we just had to fall back and realize that the truth of the matter was we were a day late and a dollar short. But on the other hand, we don't write this off as a loss. We really accomplished some significant things, and the word is out there now. So the ball is moving. I just was contacted from British Columbia today, somebody else who's interested in making a contribution at some point along the line, and is concerned about why A&E isn't falling in with endorsements yet and this and that. So, you know, there's a lot of rocks in this road, and it's a long ball game, and it's our turn at bat, and by God, we're in the game. And Massachusetts will be coming stepping up to the plate in Massachusetts in 2 years, and would step up next year. But they have the requirement there is that it applications can only be on the odd years, so it's every 2 years.
Okay. Anybody else have a question or a comment for George?
Paul again.
Okay.
Could you clarify whether the $45,000 from the French filmmaker can be used in the direct campaigns or not? I mean, I was the impression.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's you know, that money can be used for whatever purposes we feel further the cause most effectively.
I thought there was some restriction. It had to be American money.
No, there isn't.
Oh, there isn't. Okay. And I had one other question, but I can't remember what it is right now.
Okay. Anybody else want to ask a question while Paul's trying to remember it?
Well, I want to thank Paul, by the way, for hosting an event in Cambridge that was well attended and a good meeting. So thank you.
I don't stall on this deck.
Don, go ahead.
Okay. I am planning to comply with the request that I stay on the call after it's over. I would like to invite Paul to stay on the call after it's over also, because there is a particular subject that I'd like to talk to him about in
That's
his
okay.
status as a professor. If
sure,
there are any
okay.
other professors.
Okay.
Involved.
Okay. We're just going to adjourn, and then we can go back into discussion mode. Everybody's welcome to stay on the call, but I have a particular thing in mind to talk with you about, Don. And actually, I would like Sheila to be there, too, if she can. But
I guess we'll all stay on the call.
Yeah, we'll stay on the call. Okay. So, does anybody else have anything for George? Because George is the fundraising director for the campaign, and he's got all this information. He is your man if you want questions about finance. Okay.
Okay. Can I would like to repeat my George. You don't mind if I repeat my question in a different way?
No. I love meetings. I work at home alone, and I love meetings because it gives me a chance to mix and talk with people. So.
Okay, I thought Massachusetts is a great opportunity because it's close, and I'm in New York State. We can't do this kind of thing in New York State, but Massachusetts is close enough to New York City that people in Massachusetts can identify much more clearly with their state doing something, an initiative. A commission about 9/11 than I would think would be the case in Oregon and Colorado. I mean, I think it's just going to be harder to get people to sign on the dotted line in Oregon and Colorado. Now, am I wrong? I'm not talking about money now. I'm talking about getting people's name on a petition.
No, I don't think so at all. I think you're dealing with two very progressive states who are both familiar with the ballot initiative. Matter of fact, when I came home last night, was going through some of my emails. I looked at a great one that Sheila had sent out about psychologists looking at the issue of denial, and it was one of the issues, by the way, that an organizer in Toronto had addressed. But at any rate, all of the psychologists, well, no, not all of them, but several of the main ones in the 15-minute program, I think, were from Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah, but Boulder's not Colorado Springs. Colorado Springs has got a huge Air Force.
You're absolutely right. But Colorado has balance. I don't see it as being. And let me address something else here. What would that should give us all great sort of a thrill? I think, one of the things Senator Gravel says is that having this knowledge and not being able to do anything about it makes people cynical. Now, what I noticed in Massachusetts was that people who otherwise would be cynical or dismissive, it's just always that way, it's always going to be that way, don't bother, they would look at this thing and suddenly you'd see a glimmer. You'd see a glimmer in their eye that you know, it's like a campfire that you're trying to rebuild, and there's just one little ember down there, and you see that ember, and you know, aha, I can get this fire rebuilt. And so what we did in Massachusetts is we found that little spark of hope, and that came from people that otherwise wouldn't have given it, you know, a second thought. And so when we go, you know, we started the Glimmer in Massachusetts, and it's going to become a, you know, let's just carry that agenda, that metaphor a little further. It could very, very well become a grass fire throughout this nation. And, you know, that's what we're all hoping for.
Anybody else have a question for George? Okay, well, George, thank you very much for coming on and answering these questions.
Oh, I'd have been on earlier. I just overlooked it. I was asleep for a while there, and so I'm on. I want to listen.
Great. Before you go, though, I want to ask you personally: are you able to talk with me tonight by phone when we're done here?
Yeah.
Okay.
I let me call you if you would send me an email.
I'll do that. I'll send you an email when
I'm supposed to make after this.
No problem. I'll send you an email, and then you can just call me when it's convenient, okay?
Great, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we were going back into the discussion. I wanted to make a comment, and then behind me was Craig, I think, to speak on the thread that we were pursuing.
Are we going to adjourn the call anytime soon, Ken?
Thank you for reminding me. If there's no objection, we will adjourn the business meeting of our teleconference at this point, and then just continue an informal discussion. Does anybody have an objection to adjournment? Hearing none, we're adjourned. Okay. I'd like to.
Good night, everyone. Nice to talk, everyone.
Good night,
Adam.
Yeah, thank you, Adam. Thanks for holding on.
You're welcome. Bye.
Okay. I'm going to have to make a comment about what Sheila said, and this is perhaps not all that heuristic, but. It seems to me that the notion of the sin of omission that she was talking about is just another name for what I would call the incompetence approach, which I consider to be the third tier underneath made it happen on purpose and let it happen on purpose, is the incompetence approach. That's the next tier down. And I think it helps to be able to see that that's really what's being argued underneath the surface is basically an argument of incompetence. That's going to be the out with those kinds of approaches. So having said that, I'll turn it over to Craig. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I would actually not even describe it as the third tier. I would say it's kind of a counter-argument, because if you can convince people it's incompetence, then what you're convincing them is that the government didn't do it on purpose. So I would even say it's kind of like an official story version plus incompetence, I guess. I don't know if maybe I've already said this sufficiently. I don't know, but I guess what I feel is that this idea of selecting evidence, I think it's really fundamentally wrong. Like the idea of picking the best evidence, and it says it on that website. It says it in Mr. Griffin's book. I've heard it from lots of people who kind of think the World Trade Center is really where all the action is. And I really think that's kind of where the agenda has been going, and I think it shouldn't. I think, you know, it's like I sort of liken it to a murder investigation, you know. Like somebody that's investigating somebody for murder doesn't just pick their favorite piece of evidence and just stick with that, you know. Well, we have, you know, fingerprints on the gun, so we don't need to worry about the rest of it. You know, and I think if we kind of let that happen, then what we'll end up with is a watered down case, which is not going to convince anybody. I mean, I look at the consent. I had forgotten what the item on the is.
Hello?
Yeah.
What's happening here?
I don't know. Okay, so I'll go on, I guess.
Yeah, I just continue. I don't know what that noise was.
On the Consensus 9/11 website, there's one that's the best evidence on the Pentagon, and that's the fact that the four that the two.
Somebody's dialing, and we're hearing the dialing. Is somebody dialing a number? If you can, star 6, and then we won't hear you dialing. Thank you.
Okay. The only one that they list is the fact that the pilots didn't enter the four-digit squawk, like hijack code, and that's the entire case, according to that, on the Pentagon. Interestingly enough, the one on Shanksville, right below it, says the fact that people did not observe any plane at the site of where the crash is supposed to have taken place. I kind of thought there's a certain irony in the fact that in one case we think it's strong evidence to say there's no plane, and then at the Pentagon, you know, we don't want to mention that for some reason. So I guess that's pretty much, that's pretty much it for me, I guess. Thanks.
Sheila, can I chime in?
Sheila, go ahead, and then I guess I'd like to go after you. Go ahead.
Well, I agree with you, Ken, that saying sin of omission is essentially incompetence theory. And the reason I'm phrasing it as sin of omission is because I think that if you phrase it in a certain, if you think of it as a criminal investigation, you can just see how much easier it is to form excuses for not having done something. You know, an example I've given to some people, and I may have said this on the listserv, is that suppose I've been accused of killing someone, and you've got the DNA from my sweat on the rope that, say, I used to tie them to the train tracks. Well, now that's pretty incriminating. You've got my DNA on that rope that is found on the dead body on the train tracks. Now, wouldn't I much prefer to distort that to someone else tied them to the train tracks, and I had a chance to prevent it but didn't? You know, and I could think of just how, you know, my excuses could rack up about all the reasons why I didn't prevent it. You know, I tried, but the other person was stronger than I am, or my car didn't have any gas in it, or I didn't get the message in time, or I thought that they were filming for a movie, or, you know, it just could go on and on. And I guess I feel that, that when we surrender that sin of commission, of actually in advance taking down those light poles, that kind of thing, that we're, you know, we're giving up so much, and that's why I keep harping on it.
Don Stahl on the stack.
Okay. Well, let me just say in response to what Sheila said, I concur with that, but I think the key to understanding the approach of incompetence is pretty much what you're saying. It's exculpatory, okay? It's an exculpatory hypothesis, and that's why there's a very shady line between let it happen on purpose and incompetence. It's very, you can easily slide from kind of one to the other, depending on which hypothesis you want to pursue, or who you want to see ultimately fingered for the crime. So to me, it's easier to see this as a continuum rather than, although I do take Craig's point about there being a contradiction between that latter hypothesis and the made it happen or let it happen. But anyway, the reason that I wanted to ask Don and Sheila and Craig in particular, but anybody else who might feel called to this, is that I want to say that my experience on this call is that among us, we have some extremely knowledgeable, informed, and articulate people who are very much at the forefront of 9/11 truth thinking. Okay, and the kind of conversation that we're having tonight suggests to me that we need a way of better communicating to the public the kind of thinking that's going on in this, let's call it a forum, okay? I would like to challenge Don Stahl to develop his theory, or not his theory, but his thinking about the, let me see how I can phrase this, the difference between the consensus approach, the purpose of the consensus approach, and the difference and the purpose of internal debate, and why those two things are different. Okay, that's one approach to this whole thing. Sheila's is the infiltration hypothesis and how that's affecting the movement. And then Craig's is the problems created by over-selection of evidence and how that dilutes the message to the public, in his opinion. All of these are somewhat conflicting, but also equally valid in their own way, and should be developed in contradistinction to one another, but also in dialogue with each other. And if we had a way in which to do that, and I would like to try to work toward having a way to do that, to make this, to develop these things further into a formal kind of presentation, and then to be able to present it publicly, mostly for the benefit of the 9/11 Truth Movement, to put it out someplace where people can see it and give it some exposure, and then maybe to develop a kind of discourse in some format somewhere that would become where people start looking to find out what the 9/11 truth issues are and are being addressed and so forth and so on. I think we should really give some thought to that. I just wanted to say that in passing and ask Don, Sheila, and Craig in particular if they would consider working up their, what they had to say tonight, their basic theses, and seeing if we can't put them someplace where they can attract more attention.
I think that's a great idea.
Who's that speaking?
That's Craig, sorry.
Okay, so Craig, you would be willing to do something like that?
Sure.
Okay.
Can I just make a quick comment?
Don was on the stack. So
I'm sorry.
I would just like to hear a quick response from Sheila and then let Don speak, and then you can go ahead after Don.
Sure.
Craig. Okay?
Sure, yeah.
Sheila, what would you say to that?
Well, I actually have been thinking that I really should write this all up in a detailed article, like that I would maybe try to have published someplace like Global Research, now that the Democratic Free Press is no longer in motion.
Well, I think you're right. I think, excuse me for interrupting, but I think Global Research might just be the right forum to start this thing out on. It, but I don't think it should be just your thesis. You see, I think these are all different ways of trying to apprehend the same problem that we're facing as a movement. And if all three of you could make an independent contribution that could then be seen together, and people could look at it from Sheila's point of view, then from Craig's point of view, and then from Don Saul's point of view, I think that would be a very beneficial exercise. That's what the way I was trying to look at it, but that's just my thought.
Well, Craig, in essence, is already getting his viewpoint out there because he has a blog.
Okay.
Ken, can I make a statement? Sheldon.
Sheldon, I'll put you on the stack behind Don Stahl.
All right.
So, Don, or would you respond to my question, please, and then go ahead and take your turn to speak, and then Sheldon's behind you.
Okay. Since it's my turn to speak, I'm going to use that to address several things. One is my contribution to the subject has been online for, I think, about 4, maybe 5 years, I don't know how long it's been. It's called Activists as Knowledge Workers. And before I forget, I also have a blog, though I haven't looked at it myself in years, but it does have some stuff on it, and I think Activists as Knowledge Workers is on that. Now the other thing, one other thing is addressing what Sheila was saying about convincing in a court of law. The point, Sheila, when you envision that kind of a setting, you are thinking of convincing, you're addressing either a single individual or a panel of 12, and those individuals have nothing else to do but think about what you're saying. That's their job for the time being. That is a very, very different setting than stopping somebody in the middle of their life and saying, hey, you need to look at this for at least a second. That is the point of the distinction. So that's why you don't say the same things to everybody. The last thing is, one other thing. I thought originally when you asked me to stay on the call, I thought you were going to talk to me about Judy Woods. In case that gives anybody any concern, my review of her book is in two parts. If you Google Donald Stahl, Judy Woods, you'll probably get both of them. You could read it. The second part is the most important. Paul Zaremka is still on the line. Are you, Paul?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to address this to you. There is a book called 6 Degrees. It's by Duncan J. Watts, and it is about social networks and the theory of social networks, what theory there is so far. It takes up where Malcolm, the tipping point, Gladwell, left off, okay? So this is the latest word. This is what I'm talking about, Duncan Watts' book. In it, he mentions the concept of the vulnerable cluster of people. I won't try to say what that is right now. You can find it in the book. But it's my idea that professors are such a vulnerable cluster. For example, the professors in a certain department all over the country, philosophy professors, economic professors. If I have been trying to get published a philosophy paper, it's difficult. It's because it's 66 pages. Some of the journals I send it to won't even admit that they have received it. Some others send it back, don't send it back, but they say this has been rejected by the editor without being sent to be refereed. But the idea is, if I could get this published in a philosophy journal, that would be one way to crack this vulnerable cluster of philosophy professors. Have any professors in the 9/11 truth movement thought of this? You could 9/11 touches on so many different things. There's an economic angle to it. If you could get something with that slant in an economics journal, I think that would be a valuable thing to try to do. So I don't know if I will succeed in getting this thing published. It's called The Epistemology of September 11, and it's got a lot of pictures in it, too. So if it doesn't get published as an article, it's going to be a book, but that will be at least a year in the future. And so with that, I will turn the floor over to the next person.
What was the name of that book again, Doug?
6 Degrees. Duncan J. Watts, Watts.
Thank you.
I think Shelton is next.
Yeah, Shelton's next. Go ahead, Shelton. Thank you.
I was just going to suggest that the piece that I plan to work on be included in the list, because it could be an insider's perspective of the consensus panel. I don't know what it'll say exactly yet, but I think it would be relevant.
What is your thesis, Paul? What would your thesis be?
That the selection of the participants and the items to be considered predicted the outcome completely.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a pretty—it's relevant. So yeah, definitely, I could see why you'd want to include that also. I mean, I think the whole question, if I may interrupt here for a second, is that we're dealing with here is this whole notion of should we be moving toward a consensus? What is the value of moving toward a consensus? What are the drawbacks of moving toward a consensus? And just weighing it in those terms. And some of the parameters of moving toward a consensus that Sheila could bring in from her infiltration hypothesis, you know, how that affects the whole notion. But the whole thing stems around this idea of, you know, ought we be moving to consensus? Is it a beneficial direction? I think that's the key question that we've been discussing underneath everything else here. Who else would like to speak?
Craig is waiting.
Okay, Craig.
And I'll go on the stack after Craig.
Okay.
I think just what struck me as you were saying that is, for me, I'd want to kind of define what we're all talking about when we say consensus, because I think different people seem to think it means different things, at least in terms of this situation. For me, consensus, like what I think we've seen up to now with Richard Gage and David Ray Griffin and this whole thing is that consensus means you take people who are on opposite sides of the issue, and you know you kind of give both like veto power over essentially you know the evidence, and which ends up neutralizing all of the strongest evidence. So I think that you know that to me isn't consensus. That's just like eliminating the areas of disagreement, and then just being left with whatever's left over, which I don't call that a consensus. I like the idea of what you were suggesting, Ken. I think that's who was saying that the idea of somehow combining forces in some way. I mean, we all have, you know, different ways of maybe expressing our opinions. I mean, I would love to think that hundreds of thousands of people read my blog every day, but that's not really the case. So, you know, so I like the idea of somehow kind of a joint effort of some kind to get the idea across that they're that we're not all just kind of isolated with our own views. And to me, when we're talking about convincing the public as opposed to people on the inside, I know how I was convinced. I wasn't in the inside, and I was convinced by the sheer weight of the evidence. I mean, I started looking at the World Trade Center, and that was incredible. And then I looked at the Pentagon. It was just like, it was all so strong that it was like at the end of it was like, well, there's no way I can believe that this wasn't an inside job with all of this incredible evidence. So that's what I was saying before about thinking it's a mistake to kind of focus on what people think is the best evidence. So I kind of think we need something that's an alternative to this idea of Griffin's consensus approach. I think we need something that, you know, that sort of goes after, makes the official story kind of the thing that's on trial, and have like, you know, make up the 20 reasons why the official story is a lie or something like that. Something that, you know, people can kind of grasp quickly. You know, there'll be more impact with that. That's what I think. So that's it for me.
Well, I think I'm next.
Sheila, I'm after you. Go ahead.
I think really the consensus approach is ridiculous. I don't feel any, sympathy for that idea at all. And it's one that's often taken by journalists who are saying, trying to present both sides of the story in an even-handed way, as if both sides are making an equally valid point. Well, you could say that the attractive young woman who's walking down the street late at night and the rapist who jumps out from behind the bushes and rapes her had a disagreement, and you could do a story and get both sides of their story. However, the truth is there was an innocent person and then there was a rapist. So just because two people have a disagreement doesn't mean both of them have an equally valid point of view, or that the truth is to be found somewhere on the 50, you know, yard line in between those two points. So what I see happening with David Ray Griffin and also Richard Gage is embracing many of these same people, Cole Chandler and who's the other one that's in there?
Legg and Hoffman.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them, is that they are embracing people who are have, in my mind, been completely discredited. They've been discredited by the things they've written and the lies they've written and the way they've attempted to deceive the movement. You know, anybody who wants to cite Jim Hoffman as a source is suspect in my eyes. Jim Hoffman used to say that no plane hit the Pentagon. He said that up until about 03, at which point he made a 180-degree turn and started to say that the plane did hit. So what happened in 03 to change his mind? He never has said. And the means that he uses to try to prove all kinds of things, such as the plane could be seen from anywhere all around the Pentagon, are all extremely dishonest. And then we see all these other people, such as David Ray Griffin and Richard Gage, who should know much better, who should know better. They're smart men who are quoting him and saying he's a source to look to on the Pentagon. So it's, I got so carried away there, I kind of forgot what point I was making, but I'm maybe I should just hand the floor over then to Ken.
Thanks. Don, I'd like to ask you very quickly before I go into my other question. You do defend the consensus approach, but only with a limited purpose in mind. Is that a fair characterization of your position?
I don't think so, because okay. I would want to make my position more detailed.
Well, then let me ask the question this way to everybody. Is there anybody among us that believes that there is merit in the consensus approach?
Merit?
Merit, yes.
Not in the way it was carried out, no.
In other words, okay, but you could conceive that there could be merit in a consensus approach if it were possibly done, approached in a different way, correct?
There's consensus that results from a thoughtful agreement on certain things, and there's a process that leads you to a lowest common denominator. Very different.
Aha. Yeah. Aha. Okay. That's a very interesting insight.
I'd like to get on to this.
The other question I wanted to ask was, I'm having some trouble. Paul was here. I think I just lost my other question. I'll pass and let somebody else go, and then I'll come back later. Who wants to go next?
Could Craig go at some point?
Craig, go ahead. And then who else wants to go?
Paul.
Craig and Paul. Go ahead, Craig.
I just want to echo what Shelton said. I think that's exactly the difference. When people kind of goodwill are getting together who you know, generally are like-minded and they kind of, you know, work out sort of what they can agree on, it's not just a case of, well, let's figure out what we already agree on and let's just pretend the rest of it doesn't exist, which is what's happening now. And I agree with Sheila also that the people that, I mean, Griffin's made things, I think, much worse by, in Toronto, he didn't even present the evidence that he presents in the book that there was no plane. That at least was more 50-50, but in Toronto it was just constantly quoting Legge and Chandler. I think these people have no credibility, as Sheila said, on the Pentagon. I mean, some of the things they say, I mean, I think it was Frank Legge that says that the hole in the Pentagon was large enough to fit the entire plane, like wings and all. This is just like, but there's no evidence cited. It's just like it's a joke, I think.
Go ahead.
Okay, Paul's next, and I'm next, and then Sheila.
I'll go after Ken.
I just want to know, get somebody to help me understand why you're so concerned about the consensus issue. I just don't think I don't think this consensus thing has really caught fire. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know why it deserves so much time.
Was that for me?
No. Were you directing that, Paul, or is that an open question?
Open question.
Okay. Then I'll take my turn in the stack and respond to it partly. I think the answer to the question is not because it's caught fire in the grassroots, but because much of the leadership of the 9/11 Truth Movement seems to be moving in that direction, and using that term. And certainly, you know, David Ray Griffin is among those that is, you know, hastily promoting this approach to how we make our case to the public.
Who else? Who else?
Well, the people, I would say, who were behind the 9/11 at the Toronto conference were trying to implement this to some degree. Okay, did not in any overt way, but I believe that it was their methodology. But maybe others could speak to that if they disagree. But that was my thought. But I would like to go back to the question I was going to ask in the first place, which or a comment really, and that is about our ability, or the, what I see here as our potential, and why I brought this idea up in the first place of doing this many-sided approach to this question, is a maturing of the 9/11 truth movement. Okay, in the past we've had our profession of the 9/11 truth. But what I believe we're experiencing here on a certain level, which I think is a very exciting development, is that we're moving into the direction of becoming self-reflective, okay, of noticing our own tendencies as a movement, and then challenging those, or at least giving them a critique. And what I see us moving in the direction of towards, if this thing can go somewhere, is almost like having a journal of 9/11 truth movement development, or issues in the 9/11 truth movement sort of thing, so that people who are already part of the 9/11 truth movement would have a place to bring their theory, their theses about the 9/11 truth movement's tendencies, pro or con, and so forth and so on. In other words, a journal not a lot about 9/11 truth, but about the 9/11 truth movement and its issues, okay? Which is what I think we've been discussing tonight, is the issues in the 9/11 truth movement rather than, as we have in the past often, certain aspects of 9/11 truth. That was just my thought. I had to finish that. So, Sheila, go ahead.
Well, I'd like to respond to a couple of people. To Don Stahl, who says, there are messages for the public. I don't know that that's entirely true. I feel increasingly that I'm having to kind of send a message to my fellow truthers, because many people just engage in a kind of hero worship about the leaders of the 9/11 truth movement and tend to feel that if it's said by one of these leaders, it must be true. And they're taking a very non-analytical and non-reflective approach to things that are said by folks like Richard Gage and David Griffin. Now, this is really dangerous, in my mind, if you have Richard Gage and David Griffin rejecting some of our most incriminating evidence around the Pentagon, because I could see that the bulk of truthers seem to want to just follow along blindly. I've seen this some in my own local truth group. There are people who are still kind of worshiping at the altar of Jim Hoffman because of all the work he did so early on about the WTC, thinking this guy could not possibly be wrong. So, yeah, I do feel that that we still have to give a message. We have a message for the truth movement. And to Ken saying, we're becoming more self-reflective, well, I would have been happy to continue to focus all my energy outward on trying to get the message to those who don't know anything about this, who aren't truthers. But when I saw, first of all, starting a couple years ago, how 9/11 Blogger was censoring the truth about the Pentagon and this incriminating fact of a faked plane crash at the Pentagon, they were censoring that. And then I wrote an article about that, which was published in The Creek back in November. And then that immediately after that article came out, this group from the board of directors on A&E started coming out with their articles, basically trashing The Creek and reinforcing their view that, of course, the plane hit. And then in February, you got Richard Gage doing his complete withdrawal of support of CIT. So it's only because I see the truth movement kind of falling off a cliff that I feel that I have to, at this point, address, what's actually going on in the truth movement, because I think it's really serious and really scary to feel that we are being led off a cliff. And if we do get a new investigation, and if a kind of a consensus has been formed about who the real leaders are in the movement and who should whose opinion matters and who is going to have input into how that investigation proceeds, and if all the most incriminating evidence is left out of that, we could get exactly nowhere.
I agree.
Yep. Yeah. And who is it behind Sheila? Anybody else waiting to speak?
Well, I just wanted to address a point with Paul that one reason I'm concerned about the consensus process is that my name and face is on that right now. I don't like it.
Now, where is your name and face, Shelton? Because I haven't seen this.
It's on the website, which was put up for the consensus process. It lists the members and...
I'd like to say something, Paul.
Is that on the Toronto hearings?
No, it's on the consensus website. Let me... I can get a link.
Consensus911.org.
Yeah.
Right. Can I say something, Paul, here? Hello?
Yeah, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to...
Paul, sorry, yeah, go ahead.
Part of the point I was trying to make is that we are, I mean, I'm following up a little bit on what Sheila said. We ourselves are falling into kind of their game plan by talking about consensus all the time. I mean, why don't we just forget about it and just go on to do what we want to do?
Well, maybe it's a personal item with me, so if that works for the rest of you, that's great. I've got some work to do.
Well, I do too, Sheldon, because I'm on that same. I have my picture there, but I do have my picture there. What am I talking about? Yeah, we're in the same boat, but we can clean that up between you and me and a couple of other people, and that's the end of it.
Well, it's not just that, Paul. It's also David Ray Griffin, who is sort of the godfather of 9/11 Truth Movement, just came out with a book and his Pentagon.
Why do you say he's the godfather? You are putting him in a pedestal. Why are you doing that?
Well, I do too, Paul. He's been the kind of my lodestar from the beginning, and I'm having a real tough time with how do I address that, you know?
Well, maybe it is a little bit personal because he was the one who woke me up. I mean, I had never even met a truther. I had never had anybody speak to me about 9/11 truth, but in exactly 4 years ago this summer, I read an article by Paul Craig Roberts in which he said, we were not told the truth about 9/11. And then he mentioned a book by David Ray Griffin called A New Pearl Harbor. Well, that very day, I went and got the book out of the library, my local library. I read that book over the next 2 days, and then I knew it was done for me. I was MIHOP all the way. And, I mean, that was a very shocking and, you know, for me, I mean, I felt like my jaw dropped to the floor and stayed there all week. So that's partly the personal thing, but then it's also just his sheer amount of contribution to the movement. I mean, what he's done with his 10 books. And now to have his Pentagon chapter titled A Consensus Approach and to hear from others that he is constantly saying Legg says and Chandler says and Cole says in his Toronto speech, and these are people who, in my mind, are completely discredited. It's really, you know, it's really alarming. And I know, you know, many people will not be as analytical about it as we're being. Many people will simply follow along, unfortunately.
This is George. I need to get off and return a phone call, so I'm sorry to miss the rest of it.
I'll talk to you later, George.
Thanks for
coming up.
Thanks for being here, George.
Bye, George.
Yeah. I should get off soon also, Paul.
Yeah, me too.
This is Ken. I'd like to make a comment if a few people are still here, especially to Sheila, regarding the inclusion of the laundry list of people that we talk about frequently as being on this group. What would you call it? A specialized group of above the pay experts that are always cited and so forth and so on, and it forms sort of a coterie of a mutual admiration society or whatever. Chandler is always included in that group, and I have to say that after seeing him in the Toronto hearings, I was very impressed with his way of dealing with the 9/11 truth issues. So it's hard for me to imagine that he is someone who also is basically a fake expert, or not a fake expert, but somebody whose credibility is really challengeable. Could you speak to that?
Well, I can say right off that the paper that he wrote, a co-author with Jonathan Cole, about CIT is completely dishonest.
I see.
It's dishonest in many, many respects, and CIT put together a 50-page rebuttal. I think way too long, I think, and I've told them, I think if they want people to read it, they need to make it shorter. But and in my own personal dealings with David Chandler, he has been rude and has been dismissive. He wrote me asking me essentially, did I have anything to do with that article that was published in the Rock Creek Free Press bashing a blogger, and wanted to know exactly what is my relationship with CIT. And I replied, my relationship is that of a journalist who investigated them, found them credible, and has written several articles about them. And he then asked me, am I aware of Jim Hoffman's work and what Jim, you know, and specifically Jim Hoffman's blog piece in which he uses Google Earth to supposedly prove that you could see any kind of an overflight of the Pentagon from many different vantage points. And I laboriously went through Jim Hoffman's blog piece and found the actual Street View photos for each of those locations around the Pentagon and sent them to David Chandler, proving to him that Hoffman is lying in saying that you can actually see over the Pentagon from all these locations. And never heard back from him. And then we had the idea to do a debate, and Craig Ranke was willing to do a written debate, and I worked out a format for a written debate. I invited David Chandler, among several others of these people, to participate in this debate, and none of them were willing. Frank Legg showed interest in writing about the Pentagon for the Creek until he understood that he would be debating Craig Ranke, at which point he completely said he had no interest.
God, Stahl.
Go ahead, Doc.
Forgive me, but this information brings a smile to my face because so many things have happened in my experience, similar things. I had an email exchange with William Rodriguez. I wanted to know something from him, and before he would answer my question, he wanted to know what my relationship was to Phil Jahan, and I had only the vaguest recollection of Phil Jahan, and I told him that, and I never heard from him again. And what the picture is, when you meet another truther, you ask for the password, and if you give the wrong code word, well, then you're an enemy, and then you're on the other side, and then you're a disinfo agent. I think this whole business, and Judy Wood, as far as you know. Jim Fetzer was the only person who for a long time would mention Judy Wood, and he was a big one for talking about what she was saying. This was before her book came out. And after the book came out, he had her on his show. And he used the word theory in referring to some of the things that she thought, and she took offense at that, and he told me that she hasn't spoken to him since. She simply doesn't understand that the words are used differently by different people and in different professions. In philosophy of science, theory doesn't mean what it means in the newspapers. And
but she's got a PhD.
Yeah, and so both of them have PhDs, but they're in different subjects, and that's what they don't realize. My review of her book, I thought her book was wonderful, and that's how I started my review. And what I have found is that the people, not just Judy, I have never interacted with her, but people around her have attacked me because of my review of Judy Woods. People around her, and of course, people around A&E have also don't want anything to do with me because of my attitude toward Judy Wood. So I'm in the middle of two. I'm in the in the demilitarized zone, getting fire from both sides, and I just think this whole business is it's sad if you get far enough away from it. Let me just say this. What I think we should do as a movement is, if somebody has, whoever it is, if somebody has an idea for something to be done, like the Gravel campaign, I support it entirely. I will work with anybody who will work with me, and I'm not going to be an enemy of anybody, and I'm not going to tell anybody what they shouldn't say, period. So that's all from here, okay?
That sounds like a nice note to conclude on, it, unless anybody has anything else to say.
This was an amazing phone call.
Yeah, it really was. Okay, I think it's definitely, if not the best we've ever had, it's certainly been one of the most productive. I have certainly felt privileged to be a part of this one, because I think that we're cutting new ground here, and we're really gaining more insight into ourselves as a movement as we develop these discourses.
I want to tell you, as an old timer back from the 60s. This infighting is nothing new. This is endemic. And Paul Zarebka could probably tell you the same thing. This is the way it goes, okay? All right. Signing off. Bye-bye.
Good night. No, thank you.
Thank you.